press screening I'm missing tonight.
What? Yeah. What is that? What is that?
The sub screening is tonight.
What is it?
Dennis Quaid, which looks in Margaret Qualley. It looks kinky-ish. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. That's well, not the show that... right now.
So, it looks weird with the parallel and all that. I'm like, it looked weird. So I'm like, yeah, you've piqued my interest. Whenever you get a wide release weird film, that always appeals to me.
Well, and we're definitely going to talk about a wide release weird film tonight.
That's right.
And yeah, there's a press screening going on tonight, which is why we've got a lighter panel, but still an awesome panel to boot. We are three of Earth's Mightiest Critics. I am Ian Simmons of Kicking the Seat. We have Mark the Movie Man Krawcheck of Special Mark Productions and the Spoiler Room Podcast, and Don Shanahan of Film Obsessive and the Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, and a million other things. Mm-hmm. And we're here to talk about not just Beetlejuice, but Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Oh my gosh, hold on a second. We're about to get another guest in here as soon as
all right,
devices
all right,
are connected.
All right.
I can see him down in the waiting room, but yeah, we'll have to let him in a second. But that's the big movie this past weekend, the big sequel that was out, and I think it outperformed a lot of people's expectations. It was like $110 million or something stateside, and didn't do as well overseas, but I can kind of understand that because this feels very specific, very niche, which is weird to say about a Warner Brothers wide release. But yeah, we're going to talk about it tonight. Hold on a second. Here he comes.
Good.
I was thinking in my head, David Fowley, David Fowley, David Fowley, and all of a sudden you appear.
Yeah.
Well, see, you don't need me now. I'll be gone. That's fine.
You know, that makes two of us.
You got David.
David, how you doing?
Doing good.
All right. Well, we are just getting started, getting warmed up here. We're going to talk a little Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. But so 36 years after the original. I mean, this is it's legacy sequel. It's Top Gun Maverick territory almost.
Same 36 years. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, that's right. Because Top Gun Maverick was
86.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. We're short of Glenn Powell. Oh well.
Yeah. He was in the movie. He had a bit part as a disco dancer in the Soul Train.
He was the snake. Oh.
he was one of the many Bobs we get in this movie, I guess.
Sandworm. Yeah.
Now I just see Glenn Powell as a sandworm. I don't know how.
Wow. I've seen him. He's got a sandworm. Yeah.
Yikes. Would have been too much to ask. I mean, it's a Warner Brothers movie, so they could have pulled this off to have just a little Timothee Chalamet riding one of those sandworms, just like in the distance.
Oh yeah. Or in the background or something. Or
even a little Tim Burton.
Or something.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't be able to tell. I mean, Tim Burton and young Timothy Chalamet, at least the hair.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then Bob Dylan, that connection too.
There you go.
The platitudes and layers are on right now. Yep.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start off with a confession. I was not the world's biggest Beetlejuice fan.
Me neither.
You know? Mm-hmm. 1988. In fact, until Friday night, I think, because I saw this on Saturday morning, I went and I revisited the original Beetlejuice on Blu-ray. And I think that's the first time I'd seen it all the way through, probably since 1988 when I saw it in the theater. Okay. I'd seen bits and pieces over, you know, the years. I didn't really care for it then because I think it's a Tim Burton kind of quirky movie, but it's also a very kind of adult movie about a lot of, you know, kind of mature things and life and death. And it's not nearly as quirky as I think people remember it being. It's very, it's very grounded in a lot of ways. And so when this legacy sequel idea came around, I'm like, I guess, you know, and I watched Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, and I, like so many movies we've discussed in recent years.
I
didn't like it. You know, big surprise.
Yeah, but
But here's the thing. Like so many movies that we've talked about in recent years, and, you know, not everyone can pull off a legacy sequel. And this falls into the category of 5 years from now, people are going to be talking about Beetlejuice, and they're like, oh, yeah, they made a sequel to that, didn't they? Or when is that coming out? It came out like half a decade ago. They made a lot of money on it this weekend, so we might see Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I don't know if I'll be there for it, but I think
they fast and furious and get to like 9.
Oh my gosh.
They're at 10. I'm still waiting for part 2, damn it.
Good luck. So is Vin Diesel.
Yeah.
No.
They need the foreign.
He's still hanging in that. What is it, like a chasm or a bridge where the.
Yeah, well, no, the bridge. There was a. He was with his son on the muscle car, and Crazy Momoa blew up the Hoover Dam.
It's still. He's still
you are all better than me. I stopped watching at 7.
Oh, I think I stopped at 8. Yeah. But see, this is my kind of discussion. We're talking about movies other than the one that I'm not that jazzed to discuss. Mm-hmm. But we are going to talk about it. And I think for me, the cleverest thing about this whole production is the title. You know, Beetlejuice, because you say his name 3 times and you summon him or you send him back to the nether world, or I was going to say the nether regions, but that doesn't sound right either. Ouch. But, you know, that's kind of my high level take. Don, what did you make of the original Beetlejuice and also the sequel, and were you psyched for it?
I was in 1988 at Midwestern Square, where this is easily one of the, and I was like, you know, 9. So this was one of the weirdest movies I had ever seen in my life in 1988. And I didn't know whether to dig it. I didn't know whether it was like, obviously you watch Keaton roll and do his thing, and that's obviously the most fun part of the movie. And by the time you're Harry Belafonte some tunes and dancing, like, how can you not have fun? But I mean, it's still kind of a movie you sit around and go, I was 9 and like looking around like, so is that what death's like? Like, what's happening here? Like, I probably put too much projection to it in my own 9-year-old brain. And since then, I also haven't like watched it religiously. It's not an annual Halloween kind of thing or anything like that. I keep it in reverence because I do think Keaton is doing something brilliant then and brilliant now. Where I mean, to me that's such a unique character creation from the actor in terms of like physical comedy quirks, screen presence, whether it's scripted or improv, like what Keaton's doing with that character, which is such a singular character, is on that list with like Hannibal Lecter and like just unique movie creations of guy, like no one else could play him. No one else could do it. It's a legendary one, lightning in a bottle thing. So for them to find it a second time, I sat, you know, three chairs down from David, or a row down from David, and I'm laughing my ass off. I'm just having fun. I forget how lighthearted, yet how, like you said, how square and grounded the original is, but like it, you know, there's a tongue in cheek during the whole time of the first one, and there's obviously about 600 tongues in cheeks on this one. So I was okay with that. Like if 30 years of age or 36 years of age and time turned this character into, you know, the butt of his own jokes and you know, the excuse to go have fun, the excuse to kind of meddle with his family and kind of push everyone's little buttons and have enough story that buttons can be pushed or be allowed to be pushed. I was very fine taking that trip again. And I'm with you, I don't need a third. This was just fine to kind of touch here and go. I don't need Jenna to retake over a franchise. I know it was great to see Winona Ryder and other people come back, and you can do the whole pro wrestling, you still got it, chant in the stands like you're Chris Jericho or something, but like no one, for me at least, no one screwed the pooch. Like O'Hara was wonderful, Ryder was wonderful, Keaton's off the charts. Other legacy sequels have embarrassed themselves far worse than this, where this was just the wavelength you needed to be, the weirdness you needed to be, nice meld of practical and obviously the new digital things you can do now, where nothing was off-putting and nothing too far gone in one direction or another, and just fun. David and I were at that screening where there was very much a communal experience screening, but you know, not just press but public too, and it brought the house down. It was a great time.
Cool. Mark, as the Tim Burton stan, you're not only the DC shill, but you're also Warner Brothers should have you on their payroll.
They really should.
Why not, you know? You can get it.
Huge. I know this will be a surprise. Beetlejuice struck the right chord with me when I was young, when it came out. I was a little bit older than Don. Let's see, this was what, 88 it came 88. Out. So I was 13.
Okay. Oh, so wheelhouse.
It was the perfect sweet spot. And I revisited it again. I've watched it many times. I would quote Beetlejuice randomly, constantly. in the voice. I do the voice, you know.
Hell yeah.
You know, you know, I do that. Learn to through your voice. Fool your friends, fun at parties. You know, I just quote that. When we went to Universal Studios back when I was 17, they had a little skit that they did with actors where it was Ghostbusters going after Beetlejuice. And the Beetlejuice guy was coming through the crowd. And I got this really awkward Instamatic picture with me with the guy playing Beetlejuice who looked really good, and I was just, you know, I was in seventh geek heaven there, you know. I've watched this film many times. I watched it before Beetlejuice, and watching it again, while you have a you know, the through line in there, Beetlejuice the first one is a bit dark. It covered, and I managed to talk to our good friend Katie, who couldn't be here tonight, but we talked about Beetlejuice for a while. And the first one, it covered a topic that was popular in the late 80s, because you had Heathers come out around the same time. Yeah, the whole idea of teenage suicide was in the forefront, and it does touch on that in the original, if you look at it.
Briefly, yeah.
But the story itself really is not that involved in the original Beetlejuice either. You know, a lot of people, including myself, that said Beetlejuice is a little more chaotic, which it is. But after watching the first one was it didn't have a really deep story either, but it's the characters that really helped make that story. And here in Beetlejuice, what surprised me was how well they gave a convincing enough story to the fans like myself of what happened to our characters after the events of the first one. And it was nice to see that they weren't like living in a trailer park or something. You know, you got Lydia, who is a world-renowned web star because she used her powers. You know, she got, well, I'm sure we'll get into it, but in any case, she ended up getting with this producer, and she's got her show and known worldwide. And, you know, Adelia is an artist who's actually in New York with a showing with an art shop there. I mean, they've been at least somewhat, you know, successful, more so than some other legacy sequels that might have them living in a trailer or living in the house and have the house all run down or whatnot, or have, you know, there is the elephant in the room with the troublesome actor who played the dad that, you know, but other than that, I went with the family. It was another one of those family outing movies. We don't do them often. And we all enjoyed it. We were with the crowd. We were all laughing. Took me a little while to warm up into the Beetlejuice film.
Sure.
For that first few minutes, I wasn't quite into it. I'm like, okay. And then Catherine O'Hara showed up and Winona Ryder showed up. And when they show up and then you get Beetlejuice interacting with them, that's where cool. I was like, okay, I'm back into it. You know, I felt, you know, it connected. It was great seeing Keaton do Beetlejuice again. And what surprised me is how much rope they gave Burton with this film, because you could tell he's got a lot of artistic input on this. There are a lot of homages to a lot of horror films he loves, including one near the end called, there's a wonderful movie called It's Alive that he did an homage to. There's some Italian horror homages that are in here that were pointed out to me that I missed. But yeah, for legacy sequels go, for a fan, I think they handled it the best they could for 36 years. I like the title myself, Beetlejuice, versus what the original sequel title was going to be about 20 years ago, which was Beetlejuice in Love. We've been teased this film forever as fans and thought we would never even get any incarnation of Beetlejuice. And
I know initially there was a talk of Beetlejuice goes to Hawaii or something.
Yeah, like it was
a long time ago.
But I give props to Tim Burton, because he said the only way he'd do a sequel is if he had Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice. So he held out for that, and they could never quite make it work or the right script. And then they finally got it together. They got the band back together for this. And then mad props for Beetlejuice, Michael Keaton. When he came back, the script apparently that they had for this had more Beetlejuice in it. And he said, cut me out of here. He's like, I didn't have much screen time in the first one. He's like, I shouldn't have that much screen time in this one because the story was never about me. Mm-hmm. In the first one, it's about the Maitlands. In this one's, it's about the three, the Dietzes. In this one, it's about the Dietzes and how they're handling different, you know, things after the aftermath of the first one. And so I give them props for that. Is it, if you go by movie critics, is it a really great film? No, but this was highly entertaining. The crowd we were in after about 5 minutes, like I said, when those original characters showed up and it felt like they were the original characters grown up, the audience.
We're gonna come back to that one because I have serious problems with that contention. Mm. But go ahead.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying that as far as the audience that I was with and my family, we all dug it. We had fun by the end of it. We're hooping and we're laughing quite a bit. I only had, a minor couple of issues with the film, but overall, it's still, for a sequel that's 36 years in the making, I think it was better than many of us fans of the film expected it to be, even though it may not be a high bar. But it's better than many of the legacy sequels. It felt at least a little more respectful to the material than the original material than some legacy sequels, some. And yeah, we had a blast with it, and $110 million. I wouldn't have thought this was the event movie of,
I know, right?
Late summer, of 2024. I wouldn't have thought this was going to be the one where people dress up and everything. I really didn't, because I didn't realize how big of a Beetlejuice fandom there actually was until this weekend.
I am going to be very curious to see what that second weekend drop off is going to be. Because I have a feeling that it made all of its money this weekend. When I saw that number, I'm like, there's no way.
Yeah.
But David Fowley, jump in here, sir.
Yes. I too wasn't totally crazy about the first one. Just because, it was, I didn't really embrace Tim Burton until 1989 with Batman. And then I went back and I'm like, oh, wow, okay, Frankenweenie and, all these things. But I have to say that for a director, his first three movies, that's a pretty good trio. Mm-hmm. You know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Beetlejuice, Batman.
I would say his first four. I mean, you got Edward Scissorhands.
True.
I mean, look, 88, 89, 90, three bangers.
For sure. And, it's not that I didn't think Beetlejuice was good. It's just that I think, kind of like what you were, I think, hinting at was that, I was in, it was the latter years of my high school, my time in high school, and I knew Keaton from like Mr. Mom and Night Shift and all those things, and I'm like, oh, that's cool, Gung Ho. But I don't know, for some reason I just felt like this was a movie that was like trying too hard, and I got so tired of the music video for Deo and all this stuff, and so I was kind of like that high school kid where I was like, oh, okay, whatever. And then the summer of 89, so I eventually went back to it and recently revisited it again in anticipation for the sequel. And, I have to say it is easy to kind of just not necessarily fall in love, but, fall in interest with the characters played by Gina Davis and, Alec Baldwin. I think it's just, because I mean, I love what Gina Davis does with the role, and it's just an interesting concept to like start out, if you're just watching it, like say for the first time, like, okay, where's this movie going to go? You just killed off the main couple. What's happening? I mean, it's kind of great. But I came from like a Sam Raimi Evil Dead 2 fan, mm-hmm. being a Sam Raimi Evil Dead 2 fan. And even when I first watched it, which was probably even after Batman came out, I went back and watched Beetlejuice. I felt like, for kind of an afterlife thing, I get that this was kind of going light, but you could have gone Sam Raimi Evil Dead too. You know, it's like, yeah. You could have got even crazier, you know. But you know, there's some really fun moments in that, you know, like when Gina Davis, when they're trying to scare the mate, you know, the Dietzes, and it's just, it's funny because at that point it was kind of, I wouldn't say the apex of goth, but you know, goth was still around, and it's like nothing is scaring anybody who's involved in goth, and that was kind of funny. So the curiosity obviously was like, okay, then.
Well, that's, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, wow, that's a cliffhanger. go, David.
I can see though.
It's like fast, this is like Fast X. No,
I can see where he's coming from. Where you have it by 1988 standards, quite a stylish explosion. Whether that is, and he's right. It's on that tail end of when this was like made to be, quote unquote, like you said, like he was saying, kind of scary and edgy. And then what, in 2 years it's the Addams Family movie and stuff like that. Like goth is now kind of fun and cool, right?
Well, but
just got picked up by a sandworm, I think.
Yeah.
I think so. I don't know what happened there.
But you ended on a perfect cliffhanger. That was really good.
Yeah.
You know, what are they gonna do with a sequel and all that? And it's not like I was, you know, waiting with bated breath. You know, it's like they had the whole toy line, they have the whole cartoon series and everything, and I'm like, okay, but kind of like Tim Burton, if Michael Keaton would come back to this role, I was probably, you know, knowing that if he could come back for Bruce Wayne, he could come back for Beetlejuice. I mean,
right,
these are his two roles, right? So I have to say I was, you know, pleasantly surprised, probably because of my low expectations and my curiosity, that this was quite funny, and it was fun. I thought Keaton was a hoot, and I'm glad that he kind of stuck to his guns. He probably has a little more screen time in this movie than he does in the first one, but you know, okay.
But it's, still not a huge amount compared, you know, considering he's a title character.
Yeah. I mean, he's in the title twice, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it could be a little, almost double the Beetlejuice, but I thought the casting was great. I love what they did with, you know, Jeffrey Jones, Charles Dietz. It's funny the way they handled it. And I was surprised. There were some unexpected approaches that I was pleasantly surprised by, you know, meeting. And one of it involved Charles Dietz with the whole stop motion animation type of thing. And then later on, when we get this kind of backstory with in Spanish with Michael Keaton's Beetlejuice explaining how he met his ex-wife, played by Monica Bellucci, I was just not expecting stuff like that, and I was like, you know, let's have more of this. Let's get crazy, you know?
Right. Let's get nuts.
Yeah, and I think that there is actually a heart of the movie that I was also surprised by, and that's the three Dietz women. You know, Catherine
O'Hara.
Right? Yeah, O'Hara. I was gonna say, geez, Catherine Hicks. No, Star Trek 4. Catherine O'Hara, Winona Ryder, and Jenna Ortega playing her kind of estranged daughter. I mean, these are interesting dynamics, especially I feel like in this movie, especially the dynamic between O'Hara and Ryder. And she was just kind of seen as this, you know, kind of flaky artist in the first movie, stepmother who, you know, Ryder's Lydia goth teenage girl didn't want anything to do with her. And I feel like it's an interesting development here, how they kind of are still, they're kind of stuck with each other, and they still have to kind of like deal with each other, but, you know, in a different way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's interesting and oddly probably relatable for some people. I'm like,
sure.
I still have to talk to my stepmother, who I probably don't like that much. And well, there's that, you know. And so, again, we also see that Lydia, as an adult, has to deal with, you know, kind of a surly teenage daughter now, But I do have a problem with Jenna Ortega. Does not look like a teenager, but whatever.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's I think true. That we all agree that yeah, she looks like college. She looks like college, yeah. But
she's fantastic, and she's totally fits the Burton esque and the family and the Deeds family and everything. But you could have got someone younger. But anyways, whatever. I still appreciate the cast, and like I said, I think there's some unexpected surprises for me that made this. Mm. Again, low expectations, but that made this, you know, a fun kind of like solid Burton going back to his roots kind of hit for me.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you didn't see it.
And good night.
No, I mean, like, here's the thing. I watching the movie, it had a high bar to leap for me. After mm-hmm. watching the first Beetlejuice and kind of seeing it for the first time the night before, because you do realize that the movie's called Beetlejuice, but it's not about Beetlejuice. Right, it's about this couple who have to solve this problem that shows up towards the end of the movie called Beetlejuice. The whole idea that they should make a sequel focusing more on this character, I think was completely wrong. And I think it's completely a Warner Brothers saying, hey, what properties, what IP do we have to cash in on? They got this whole legacy sequel thing. Let's make another movie. And they didn't need to. Let's start off with the Dietzes. Winona Ryder, you know, it's fine to see her back. I mean, she's had a resurgence with like Stranger Things and I guess other things. But watching her in this movie, there is no connection between the Lydia from this movie and the Lydia from the first movie, because I cannot believe that person would have fallen for this sleazy, cheesy producer guy with the ponytail, who is clearly manipulating her, is clearly either insincere or a complete dweeb. I don't think she would have had time for him. I think she would have been reluctant to get into this whole like TV star personality thing. It would have made her completely uncomfortable. Now, there's an argument to be made that yes, it's been 36 years, you know, and people grow. But the problem with a legacy sequel is if you're going to make this dramatic a change in a character, we need to see those in-betweens because it just doesn't.
Well, instead of talking about them, because they talk about how the impact of her losing her husband, who she really loved.
Love of her life.
Mm-hmm. She did have a lover of her life.
No, but here's the thing. The Lydia from the original movie, there was no inkling of any kind of attraction to anybody or anything. She was the isolated, kind of icy goth.
I don't think she's even attracted to Thoreau here. It's just a character of convenience because, like, a leech is there to leech, but it's not that reciprocated from Lydia. Not a lot. No, there's dependency, but not affection.
What I'm saying is,
yeah,
Lydia was a side character in the original movie, and that's fine.
True. Yeah.
But if you're going to make an entire film that is based on her now as one of the main characters in the film, I think you need to dig into that and explain a few things. Because again, even this relationship with the guy that, you know, was the father of Astrid, who's Jenna Ortega's mm-hmm. character, I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. Lydia didn't seem like the whole like falling head over heels in love type thing. I would have loved to have seen a movie about how that guy, that cheesy environmental activist guy with the big heart, you know, won her over and got her to care about stuff. Because the Lydia from the original movie, I don't think she would have cared about the planet or saving anything. She was very much into death and,
go ahead, Mark,
you know, goth stuff.
She was up until the very end. In the very end, she changed not only her look, but her personality. She warmed up to the Maitlands. The Maitlands taught her there was more to life than wanting death. And mm-hmm. so by the end of it, she was a different character than she was at the beginning.
And I maintain that is one of the problems with the original Beetlejuice, mm-hmm. because that is literally the last 5 minutes of the movie, three of which mm-hmm. are her singing Deo and levitating. She goes through a complete personality shift in the course of, I don't know what the time jump was, but the whole like
teens
third
are moving,
act
man.
Of Beetlejuice is very
characters
rough.
Have growth. I mean, that's
right.
Without it, but what is she? You know.
No, but what I'm saying is there are different ways to approach this. My answer to what's wrong with this story, and you know, and where these characters have been, my answer is don't make this movie. My answer is Tim Burton, prove to the world that you can actually come up with something original and not just go back to, you know, what has he been doing for the last, you know, 15 years? He's been doing Disney live action remakes.
Yeah. Big Eyes.
He did his own.
Okay. Movie. Yeah. Sure. And Dark Shadows, which I think is a much better movie than this was, except Agreed. For Chloe Grace Moretz turning into a werewolf. But he hasn't done anything that Peculiar suggests that children. He is anything. Hmm?
Peculiar Children.
Oh, yeah. The School of Peculiar Children.
Miss Peregrine's.
Yeah.
Which was also adapted material.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
All he's been doing is Burtonizing. Like, you can just see these cynical cold Hollywood executives saying, hey, we got this kind of a Tim Burton-y thing going on. Let's get Tim Burton to adapt this. Burton. Right. It's McDonald's. It's this generic stuff that, and he doesn't even write these things. No, like, that's the other things. I was watching these movies. And, you know, this was written by Al Goff and Miles Millar, who have their own, you know, kind of filmography, right? But even the original Beetlejuice, he put his directorial stamp on it. People say, oh, well, what about The Nightmare Before Christmas? That was Henry Selick. Right. You know, this, all of these him, things, like, he comes in and he puts that Burton TM on things.
Sure.
And that's fine. That's but if no I'm going to watch
Fincher, Spielberg, like most of those guys bring their game for the game that is required, you know, like
Frickin' Transformers has produced by Steven Spielberg above the title.
But here's the thing. We are not that, you know, as well as anybody, Mark, that an executive producer credit does not the same thing as being the author in terms of being a director. That's not fair.
And, you know, and even, I mean, Spielberg's first movie he wrote was like in a while. Wasn't Fableman's his first screenplay in,
Since Close Encounters,
I think.
That's a long, like, that's him rightfully enjoying his wheelhouse to borrow a good story.
No,
let
but
a good
here's the thing.
Come in and I can put a TM
Steven, on. You can tell Steven Spielberg by certain hallmarks, but he does. You cannot say that he goes and directs the same movie over the course of 30 years.
So true.
No, that's all that Tim Burton really does. He keeps making the same thing over and over again. So when I come to watch Beetlejuice, I'm thinking, is there anything new here? Is there anything to add to this story to enrich the characters? The answer is no, because the heart of the original movie was the Maitlands. I mean, in this movie, there's two, I think, great scenes in this movie. And one of them is Jenna Ortega just riding her bicycle through the town. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of whimsical, and she's kind of like letting her hair down. There's nothing weird about it until she crashes into her would-be boyfriend's, you know, fence and treehouse. But that she pedals past the what used to be the Maitland hardware store, and now it's a cafe or something like that, right? So it was a kind of a nice little nod.
Yeah.
And I understand that the Maitlands had moved on. You know, they somehow got, it was literally a somehow Palpatine Returns moment. They're like, what happened to the ghost who lived in the attic? Oh, they figured something out and they moved on. I'm like, okay,
Again,
I'm sitting here thinking about the mechanics of the story. Like, oh, they didn't bring them back because Davis and Baldwin. Well, we already know what's going on with Alec Baldwin. Right. So I'm sitting there the entire time, hoping to be entertained and engaged, like, you know, intellectually on some level, and even like pull at the heartstrings. But the entire time, from the opening cynical calculation of we're just going to get Elfman to repeat his score and we're going to do the same fly through the town, the same this, it's all member berries and like financial decisions and not creative decisions. There wasn't anything in this movie that surprised me. The only thing I thought was really surprising, the connection I drew, was I thought the subplot with the boyfriend was kind of interesting and kind of chilling when you see what they do to his parents. However, it's the same plot from Ghostbusters Afterlife, another movie that had 15 plots stuffed into it of like, oh, I've met this person and we're becoming friends and we've got a bond. And oh, they're secretly a ghost trying to trip me into getting into the afterlife so that they can, you know, take over or whatever.
Is that Frozen Empire or Afterlife?
Frozen Empire. Yeah. Okay, right. They're both the same movie and neither one of them are good.
Oh, dear.
And the other, it also had shades of the Halloween Kills from a few years ago with the girl falling out with the guy who turns out to be, you know, an agent of demons. Okay. There is nothing in here that, you know, grabbed me at the end. Like, hey, look, it's the pink wedding dress again. We're going to have another botched wedding ceremony again. We're going to have a sandworm swoop in and eat the villain again. There's no reason to watch this movie. That's my contention.
I found myself while watching this kind of I was noticing that, wow, there's a lot of characters in this movie, but I was also kind of impressed with the way they were all kind of juggled together and not tripping over each other.
Right.
Agreed. At least I didn't think so. I felt like there may have been a character or two that wasn't needed. Like, I don't really think you needed to include the dead ex-husband. I don't think you really did. I think you could have even done away with it. Like, maybe she never got married and she was, you know, Astrid was just estranged from her mother because her mother's weird and she didn't want to be associated with that. You know, it could have been that. But I kind of agree with Ian. Like, if you're going to have Lydia.
Astrid?
Yeah. Astrid,
the daughter?
Yeah. I'm dead. but if you're going to have Winona Ryder's character, if you're going to have her have this lost love, then or former flame, it would have been nice to have a little bit more screen time or explanation about that. Even if you did some kind of, since Burton was doing these quirky flashbacks, you could do something with that too. I'm fine.
Lydia's love story.
Yeah. Or something. Or even even when they were flipping through the photo album in the attic, you could have done something a little bit more creative with that.
Yeah.
Them meet again in the whole afterlife thing, it felt kind of useless and kind of like unexplored.
Played
for laughs too much with all the piranhas all over him too.
Well, yeah.
which brings to mind questions like, you know, again, I'm taken out of the movie because I'm like, so those piranhas are nipping at him. Are those the ones that ate him and they're also dead and that's their afterlife? What the hell is going on with this movie? But no, yeah. David, I agree with you. I think the whole subplot I'll go with Monica Bellucci is completely wasted in this movie.
Yeah,
she shows up, just built up as this building, this soul-sucking demon, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we also waste time. You guys were talking about this, the flashbacks in Spanish. I'm like, this isn't funny. I've seen this before. It's not leading to anything.
The other thing is,
by the time the movie is over and you realize that they did nothing with Monica Bellucci's character, you also realize, well, that flashback didn't mean anything either. Let's devote that to fleshing out some of these other characters. David, you mentioned that there's so many characters in some plots that don't trip over each other. I think the problem is they don't connect. They bounce off of each other. The whole thing with Willem Dafoe playing the cop. I mean, I kept thinking about you because he's like, you got to keep it real. I'm like,
You thought of me.
I did. You know, but the thing is, like, I kept thinking of the version of this character would have been Robert Downey Jr.'s Wayne Gale from Natural Born Killers, the journalist who thinks he's kind of a badass and getting to mix it up with people, but he finds himself in these dangerous situations that he's a complete poser. This Dafoe is so isolated. He's like in his office or he's like interviewing people or whatever, but it's just like, yeah, I get it. You were an actor and now you're a cop, but what are you going to do with that? Nothing. Okay. Let's cut this out. This movie is 10 minutes longer than the original with about an eighth of the substance.
Hey, but it had a Richard Marx song. That was pretty funny.
Which one?
Right here waiting for
you. Right here waiting for you.
Yeah. He's like, yeah. No.
Wherever you go.
Oh, that's right. The needle drop.
Yeah.
They also played the full version of MacArthur Park, a song that I love, but only as a meme.
Our guy Jeff York loved that part.
I was impressed with how it actually made sense for the lyrics and everything actually made sense for the movie. I was like,
for the situation they were in. Yeah,
like, what? It
loved it.
I guess I felt like, because there were so many characters going on and there were so many things happening, I felt like, you know, this is actually, I'm enjoying this slightly better than the first one. And that's coming from somebody who wasn't like nuts or crazy about the first one. You know, I just feel like there's a lot more going on here. And for some, it's kind of like throwing everything at the wall and seeing what sticks, you know, but whatever. I mean, that's kind of Beetlejuice anyway.
It's true.
Yeah,
Mark,
I mean,
what do you think? You're the diehard here.
No, I mean, it's valid points. I guess it's all what you're looking to get out of it. I know a lot of fans in that of this film that have also really enjoyed it, but I think many of us didn't go in looking that deep. And maybe this goes back to what Jeff talked to me about, what I really enjoyed Alien Romulus, and he didn't quite. He says, well, you got to look at more of the critical eye. And I'm like, I try to, but I just had fun with this film. I had more fun than I thought I would. Now, yeah, and again, when I watched the first one, there are some criticisms as far as for the story writing and that goes. It's definitely more solid as far as the story itself goes here. But I think, like with the dad, you have him show up because they established early one of the reasons why Astrid and Lydia were so estranged from each other was because Astrid didn't believe her mom couldn't see the dead. More so, she thought it was bullshit because her mom didn't see her love of her life, her dad. Yeah. And so we find out the dad has been a social worker working the soul train, which, God, I love that sequence. I'm sorry. I was like, I was like, thank you for going there. I didn't think they would, but the fact that they did, even if it might not make a whole lot of sense, I don't care because I love that they went there. But having him there, even though it was for a small scene that might feel like a throw off, because they established earlier that he was the reason why they were separated, having him show up and explain, yeah, I've been down here working the ticket booth. That's why your mom hasn't seen me around, you know, at least establishes and helps bring the Astrid and Lydia characters together a little bit more and gives Astrid some understanding. Is it the best way to go about it? Maybe not, but that's why it's there. And that's why I didn't mind it.
Well, no.
The fish showing up, if you're going to criticize that, then criticize the shark from the first two movies on the guy's leg. Criticize the snake who is wrapped around the guy walking around who is killed.
That's just this world.
I'm just going to throw that out, that the cause of death carries with you to the afterlife.
Yeah,
okay. So that's why the fish were there. So
no, well, here's the thing. If you're going to have something that doesn't make sense like that, I say don't draw attention to it. Because those things, as soon as you mentioned, they are... You know, they're sitting in the waiting room of the afterlife, whatever, and it's like, oh, that's kind of cute. Move on. In this one, it's a constant. Like every time that guy's on screen, you got these flapping things. It's kind of annoying. You know, have them hang off him or something.
And you know what would have been funny I'm sorry, but you know what would have been funny is if this character was played by Keanu Reeves, because or Christian Slater. I mean, because they've always. Both of those actors have always had like this
associations with her
association with Winona Ryder, and maybe that would be too meta or something, but whatever.
That'd be Slater.
It would have enforced my strong desire to wake up, leave the theater, and go watch Heathers. But no, I mean the whole thing with Astrid and the father. I mean it's a really cool idea, but the way that we're introduced to it is. They've got this estranged relationship. They have a conversation on the park bench, and then randomly, Astrid just yells out, oh, you could see all these other people, but you can't see Dad. I'm like, okay, so that's what this is all about. It's not elegant. It's just thrown in there. Like everything else in this movie, there's so much going on, but it's like it's in lieu of substance, it's all distraction. I mean, Mark, we talked about a movie last night called Robin and the Seven Hoods, which has just about as much going on plot-wise, but you've got well-defined characters, well-defined motivations, and at the end, everything connects and makes sense, and you don't have to make any leaps. Now, again, I don't mind that this movie exists. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to think about it again after this live stream, unless they make Beetlejuice 3, and then I'll just have to wrestle with, do I really want to waste my time? But yeah, I'm thinking about all of these legacy sequels. They're overstuffed. They seem to be IP driven, which is the Jeff Goldblum problem. We think spend so much time thinking about if we could, do we ever stop to think about if we should? And you've got this stuff, it's cluttering up these IP. Alien Romulus is a great example. Made all the money in the world, which means they're going to move forward with another one, which means there's going to be another movie shoved between Alien and Aliens. And I'm going to go back to this again. if you've got a kid growing up now who's going to get into horror movies probably in another 15 years, and they keep hearing about this movie Alien, they're going to be like, oh, I want to start from the beginning. Oh, you mean Alien? No, that's not the first one. It's Prometheus. And then Covenant. And then Alien.
And then
Alien Romulus. And by the time you get to like the two best movies, you've sat through two movies and then four movies respectively of garbage. And the whole mythos of like what made these movies special is just gone.
Yeah, there, I have feeling that's what. Lucas.
Yeah. Like once you, well, you're right though. Like once you get to three, four, or five of them, you are beating a dead, and you're wringing out a sponge. And you're right. That can happen with even just one legacy sequel. But I will help my other guys out here, these spots here. But if you can just come visit, have a good time, and even if it's a disposable theater, good time, like. I hope they stop here. I know money will tempt them to.
Oh yeah, think I want them to stop here.
Yeah, this was plenty. You know, we got. You know, you have a Lydia Arc. You have her on a good springboard with her daughter, and that's all you really need to cover. And and everyone else is going to get too old. I don't want to see Michael Keaton doing this when he's 83. You know,
I didn't want to watch Michael Keaton doing this now. I know there's a lot of Michael Keaton love. But there is no comparison, once again, between the Michael Keaton from the first Beetlejuice and this one. You can tell I understand, but I'm talking about in terms of watching a movie. You're talking about an immortal demon who's been around for thousands of years or whatever. He had this manic energy in 1989, but 36 years should be like 36 days compared to a guy who's been around that long. Yeah, you watch the manic energy that Keaton brought to that performance in 89. It's unbelievable. He's zipping around like a cartoon. Here, his introduction, he comes up out of the table and he literally shrugs. He goes, "The juice is loose." And I saw that in the trailer. I'm like, is he going to be this slow the entire time? And the answer is yes. It's just like Harrison Ford. It's just like all these actors they keep digging up and saying, hey, put on the fedora and the whip again, and let's go at it one more time. And again, it might not be fair, but in terms of like a movie going experience, I'm like, either recast, which I don't recommend, or don't make this movie do something else.
Tough call. So, for one visit, I'm down with it, you know.
I mean, as you were talking, I started thinking about there was another Beverly Hills Cop movie this summer.
That was fun too.
That wasn't good. At that.
Again, like, there's been two Bad Boys sequels.
I know.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. See, that's there too. Like, I mean, I liked Axel F. You know, that was fine for me. But I know we didn't do a show on it. But like, what helps there is, I mean, yes, by all resume purposes, he should be immensely retired. Like, no one is a cop into their 60s. Rosewood, Taggart, everybody, like, they should all be, you know, playing golf and croquet. But but for Eddie though, like, just the gift of gab, like, he's still got it, and that doesn't age to me. And Keaton to me in this movie has that same thing too. Yeah, the body might not be able to do the manic things, and the stunt double might not be able to do the manic things, but that like what Mark likes to imitate, that gift of gab and the retorts, that's all still there. And that was enough for me to be like, okay, I know you're 73 when I'm taking my lenses off to watch, but you're there and you got it. You know, you didn't lose it.
Well, I gotta say, like, I was beating up on Keaton, but I, you know, I'm one of the few people who defended The Flash from last summer. And I think a lot of that was because Bruce Wayne came back, or Michael Keaton came back as Bruce Wayne a part that required him to be the old, beaten up, broken, disgruntled version of a character that he played 36 years ago or whatever it was. And it totally works. Now, you have to make some leaps and say, well, can he still do all that stuff? Yes, it's a stunt man, but it looked cool and he still had that attitude. Playing this kind of like a human spinning top gremlin guy, I don't think it worked here. And I'm gonna go to my my buddy here, I guess, Brian S. I know a Brian S, but I don't know if I know this Brian S.
Wow.
I left the theater at the hour mark, better man than I, but part of the reason is I knew I was going to talk about it. And also, I paid hard money for this, as I assume you did, Brian. Did they give you a refund? No, probably not after the hour mark. But that's where I'm at with Beetlejuice. Although it's weird because, like, it's watching that original movie, I can't think of this title without thinking of Alec Baldwin's funny pronunciation of Beetlejuice when he was reading the flyer for the Beetlegeist.
Here's the thing with a lot of the legacy sequels, and I totally get your points on it, Ian, and I can see that. And I know a number of people who were like that, who felt that way about this film. And then there's some, like my whole family enjoyed it, you know, and maybe that was part of it. I went with my family and I'm sitting there with my two 20-something sons who are laughing at a sequel to a movie that came out 36 years ago, way before. So maybe that was part of the appeal that unto of itself was that they were enjoying something taking place in a world that I first fell in love with 36 years ago. And maybe that was part of it. I fully admit it. I've always admitted that in my criticisms, sometimes I let how I felt work into the critiques more than maybe the technical aspects of it, you know, but for me, and I'm going to say the trailers didn't do it for me. Right. And as I said, the first few minutes of this film, I was starting to get a little worried because I wasn't quite feeling it. I'm like, okay, but we get the Dietzes back in there. We get back to the real where we bring the characters in that I really enjoyed. And it was great seeing them on screen again. I love what they did with Delia, in all honesty. If anything, from the first one, you had a flaky artist wife who was the not quite evil stepmother or whatnot, but she was flighty in the first one. Here, this Adelia, she has better head on her shoulders here, even though she still gets crazy with her art. When it comes to her interactions with people, especially Lydia, there's a particular scene in here. It's short, but I loved it. It's just between Winona Ryder and Catherine O'Hara.
In the gallery? In the gallery?
It was on the, well, it was in the gallery, but also on the porch when Astrid storms off.
Yeah.
And she's sitting there and she was talking about being a teenage, you know, a mom to a teenager or whatnot. And, you know, Catherine O'Hara shows you that she can do comedy and she can do just that little emotional beat because it's just quiet. And she just goes, yeah, I remember you. She's like, you know, we still don't quite, you know, get each other, but we seem to have done okay with ourselves, you know, but it's a nice quiet beat moment. It's not an odd moment. And between these two, and I loved that moment, but Catherine O'Hara is just hilarious in here. And her character is not nearly as flighty as what she was in the first one. This is and I just, for me, it was better than what I thought the trailers showed it was going to be. And by the end of it, I came out entertained. Do we need another one? Absolutely not. I'm a super fan of Beetlejuice. And I say, no, I didn't really need this one. But it was fun to go back to this world. It was fun to see these characters. And more importantly, it was fun to see what I feel the studio giving a director again, more creative control than you might expect, because there's a lot of stuff in here I wouldn't have expected a studio to just allow him to do.
True.
And even if it's not done very well,
what? Give me some examples here.
I mean, the freaking Beetlejuice baby, for crying out loud. The fact that you have his guts spilling out. The fact that he does an ode to It's Alive near the end with the birth.
But I guess I'm just trying to figure out, like, what do you think is so, like,
I'm saying his style, the whole MacArthur Park sequence was totally Beetlejuice. The whole world in there, having Danny DeVito be this grotesque, janitor. Everything, it felt like it was the creative world of Beetlejuice that Burton played in the first one. It didn't feel like someone told him, well, you can't have a baby just suddenly drop out of Lydia between her legs and start crawling around.
But I mean, like, why would they? I mean, it's Tim Burton. You know what you're getting. Again, Tim Burton TM.
I think it would be the idea that, I mean, this is still PG-13, but, like, this is still an edgy PG-13. Like, enough... You know, like, I think what Mark's saying, they're allowing a lot more weird. And, like, I think, I mean, like MacArthur Park, like a straighter studio, but we need a more familiar needle drop there, you know, or like we need something they're going to think of four quadrants. Like, we need the millennials in here. We need this in here. We need this in here. And like, they would force a few more, shoehorn a few more style beats or things, or we need Jenna Ortega to do something cool to get, bring her audience in. Where I think I'm with Mark, like, this is pure Burton, you know, and Goffin Millar got it. And maybe that's
right. But, maybe here's
that's
the thing.
Smith before with the screenplay that still gets credit from Graham Smith. And I don't know. You know, this could have been straighter, a lot less quirky and queer, so to speak. And I can see a studio watering this down, and they didn't. So.
Well, but here's the thing. Tim Burton, I think, in their minds, is four quadrant no matter what he does. So seriously, the whole MacArthur Park. But that's the thing, is they give him all these chances. I mean, he's like Shyamalan. Yeah. He keeps popping back up. But his movies, with the exception of Alice in Wonderland, they do make money. He's still a very successful commercial director. And when you have that, it's not like, can he do this? The answer is yes, he can, because ultimately we don't care, and he's going to pull in the audience, or he's not. I mean, the whole thing, it's LOL, so random filmmaking. Like, we're going to have MacArthur Park, and an executive's been like, what's that? And the other executive's like, I don't know, Tim wants. And I'm like, okay. What, you think it's going to turn off millennials? No, because we got Jenna Ortega in the movie. Oh, really? What's she doing? She's being Jenna Ortega. Good enough for me. I'm starting to sound like the pitch meeting guy. But I briefly want to touch on Delia, right? Because her whole thing with wanting to be reunited with Charles in the afterlife, that felt wrong too. Because if you look at the relationship in the first Beetlejuice, they barely could stand each other. They moved out to the country. She hated being out there. He was like, I just want to be left alone with my binoculars and my Audubon books. But now all of a sudden, you know, and he was off on this trip again without her, and he goes down and dies and gets horribly mangled. And all of a sudden, he's the love of her life, and she can't wait to be reunited with him. And it's so sweet. I'm like, where does that come from? It's as out of left field as that whole tender moment between Delia and Lydia. It was like, I surely remember you being a surly teacher. They had no good relationship at all in the first movie, which is why, again, if you're going to take the story to this part, this is the third movie in a trilogy for which we didn't get a second entry. So none of it makes sense. And I don't think the filmmakers or the storytellers are interested in those details. They're like, let's just get Michael Keaton doing weird stuff, and we'll give Tim Burton some practical effects money so they can have slanted hallways.
And maybe this is a case, again, where I've gone over before, that I've also, with my overactive imagination, just filled in those points because I didn't like a lot of this was random. I made a lot of assumptions. Now, maybe you shouldn't be doing that with a film. You need to have the story presented in front of you. And I get that. But for me, I guess I just filled in the blanks with what I suspect probably happened, given what we knew of the characters in the first one and where we could possibly see it going. Or they were things that I'm glad it hit this beat. It was something that I was hoping they would have their relationship for later. And so maybe, you know, I did not need to see that, but I totally get that it would seem out of left field for some of it. I guess for me, maybe mentally, I filled in the blanks myself, which is why didn't mind or feel like
there's a difference between filling in blanks and there's a difference between filling in blanks and spoon feeding and having completely different characters from one film. It's like Hannibal Lecter in the sequel of Silence of the Lambs ending up being a school guidance counselor. You're like, well, I guess maybe he turned his life around. And he went to school and he loves kids and all this other stuff. But no, that's just, it's sloppy storytelling. But I want to pull over here real quick because we have an answer. Brian said, I didn't ask for a refund. I was just done. And now that is more Lydia Deetz than anything Lydia Deetz from Beetlejuice. Just walk out, head hung low. anyway, I think.
I know.
Almost.
We're
going to
beat a dead horse. Okay.
Yeah, I know. Which I would watch again. There need to be some dead horse beating. Was that like a post-credit sequence of Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice literally beating a dead horse? That would have been funny.
Yeah, it'd be cool if he woke up next to a dead horse.
Or Deadpool showed up. You're going to do this till you're 90, you know, like some of that. Yeah.
Look,
instant B plus.
I didn't think we'd ever get something like this. What we got, at least I found, was entertaining. It may not have been the best cinema, but I had a blast for it, being a huge fan of the first one and have watched it many, 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 many times. So for me, I got a kick out of it. It goes along the same as, and I know you didn't like it either, Ian, and I totally get it, and I can see why, but it's also a criticism I do have a bit with the Deadpool Wolverine film, in that the Deadpool Wolverine film, as much as people were touting, we only get one MCU film this year, that wasn't an MCU film either. That was just made as a love letter to all the comic book movies that came before the MCU phase one type of films, the Fox films.
Yeah.
But they managed to try to work it in to justify it by bringing in the TVA and that. But if you look at that film, the whole point of that one wasn't so much the story as it just was trying to do this love letter to the comic book films of the past. You know, and I guess it's just going into it with Beetlejuice. I had no expectations, in all honesty.
I didn't watch the trailer.
Because like you, Ian, I'm going to say, you know, they had talked about it, and there was fan part of me was like, well, okay, it'd be cool. But as the years went on, I'm like, I don't need it. We got it. We got something that at least had more semblance than I thought it would to the original. And when I say that they gave him a lot of leash, it's not so much in comparison of other Tim Burton films. It's in comparison to other films that are out or have been coming out lately, especially comedy films of this nature.
Agreed.
That it felt at least like they gave him a little bit more creative control and let him go a little bit wild more with the humor and such than you've seen in a number of other comedies, because in all honesty, the comedy genre has been thin for wide release films. Agreed. You know, so the fact that it's been thin and it's not a romantic comedy, this is a straight up, you know, after Black world comedy. Yeah. I appreciated it for that as well. And the artistry that went into some of the things in here was wonderful to see.
Prop master.
And I wish they would get an idea that, you know, between this, and I know many people didn't like Barbie, but if you look at Barbie too, the creative, if they would let folks let loose creatively and artistically, I think you could get a more variety of films out here. But then again, it does still resort to IP. It still does resort to IP, but at least do something different with the IP, or at least get creative.
Fine. Yeah.
You know, and I you all great criticisms for sure. And I've had debates with some other friends who didn't like this film either. It's all what you know, I guess what you're expecting or looking for, or if your brain is like mine that's broken and is filling in a lot of blanks.
Right there with you. High five.
You know,
cheer for the broken brains.
That's right.
Cheer for the broken. No, would I have liked to see? Absolutely. But I had a laugh. I had a blast. You know, I'm a Burton stan because I love his style. I've always loved his style regardless. It's like you look at a film and I go, yeah, that's Burton. You know, you just look and he's got, and outside of Alice in Wonderland and unfortunately his critically acclaimed Ed Wood, he makes money, which always surprises me, in all honesty, with some of the style of his films when you talk more of his original movies and that. But I think the underlying thing, even though this is an IP, it's showing there is an audience out there for something a little bit more weird, more. And I will say the term risk-taking, it wasn't really risk-taking, but risk-taking as far as what is normal or considered standard for what we have seen for a number of years now to now, it seems like the quirky films make money because at least it's giving something a little bit than what has been fed to a lot of the audiences for years. I mean, and I'm getting tired with the horror genre. I'm a big horror fan. I love the fact that my theater is packed with like five horror films, but let me tell you, they've been diminished returns with these horror films as of late.
They need a different edge too. Well, like you said, comedies are thin, and then this counts as a fantasy comedy, and those are even thinner. So like, it's just nice to get that breath of fresh air a bit here.
Here's my challenge, and I think would have been nice if some executive at Warner Brothers had been high ranking enough and brave enough to tell Tim Burton, okay, we're going to do a Beetlejuice sequel. You are allowed one callback and two visual references, and one of them is Beetlejuice. So you can have a sandworm, but I don't want to see that waiting room. I don't want to see the tilted hallway. Go show me something new instead of just going back to revisit this world, because all it is
do it for you. Okay.
No, because look, that reference belongs in 1991. Who the fuck remembers Soul Train except for us old fogies? And on top of that, you have it twice, and oh, they got Don Cornelius back. I wonder how they did it. Probably, you know, 50 bucks and some royalties.
Yeah.
Or maybe a ham sandwich. But it's like, yeah, it's Soul Train. It's not funny. It was clever when Freddy Krueger made a Soul Train reference in the Nightmare on Elm Street sequel like 20 years ago. But, you know, now it's like, yeah, it's Soul Train. What does it have to do with the story? Nothing. It doesn't do anything to advance the plot. It's pulling over to say, hey, remember this? I'm like, yeah, are we closer to the end credits, please? That's where I'm at.
Oh, man.
Anyway, this was our Beetlejuice review, everybody.
We're beating on Beetlejuice.
yeah, beat apple juice. Apple juice. Now I'm thirsty. But David, we've been jawboning a lot. Do you have any final thoughts on Beetlejuice?
I saw a better movie immediately after that in the same theater. Anyway,
what was it?
You stayed. Yeah, tell us.
Strange Darling.
There you go.
I've heard good things. That is the new indie darling.
Almost drove an hour to go see it, but it's already gone. So,
which means it'll be on VOD next week, probably right along with The Crow.
The Crow. No, The Crow's out this week, Friday.
This week.
Yes.
But you know what's funny about that?
You counted like, they say it's, dates.
You know what's funny about those things is they say it's going to be on streaming, right? Who's going to pay $20 streaming for that?
No one.
Here's the thing. People will, because it's a business model that they've been doing for years. But it makes a lot of sense, because if you really want to see a movie, you can justify it by saying, well, we could spend probably $25 on movie tickets to go see at the AMC plus parking and concessions, whereas I've got some instant popcorn, no gas prices, and it's only $20. So let's watch this. And if we want, we can watch it for, it's a 24-hour, 48-hour rental. If we love it, we can watch it over and over again. I never do it, by the way, just because I'm like, I can wait 5 weeks. There's a billion episodes of 90 Day Fiancé I haven't caught up on yet. I can wait for Strange Darling.
And it's going to go to the, studio model. Yeah. It'll go to the studio streaming of some sort within 3 months. And if you got Amazon Prime, if it doesn't go to a studio streaming, it'll be on Amazon Prime for far cheaper than $20.
What studio? It'll be like that?
$4.
Lionsgate for Crow, right?
So where does that usually go? Peacock?
Lionsgate?
I don't think it's.
It might be Amazon. I think it's just probably. It'll probably drop on Amazon Prime to $4. Bucks, I think the Lionsgate stuff goes to.
You got it.
Oh my gosh! All right. Well, okay. So, yeah, we're not talking about The Crow or Strange Darling, and we're not talking about Beetlejuice anymore because we've done that for over an hour. But thank you guys.
What's next week?
Next week. Next week, I am happy to announce two things going on. One, Wednesday night, and I don't think I've announced this yet, but we're going to be back doing a live stream.
Heard it here first.
Of Speak No Evil.
Okay.
Both of them?
And, yes, I'm going to be introducing a new series. It's a new gimmick. Screen to Screen. That'd be great. But no, Screen to Screen, a thing about remakes. So we're going to talk about the original foreign language film, which only came out 2 years ago. And then the new remake starring James McAvoy and our girl, David Ashling Franciosi. We'll talk about that Wednesday night. But next Friday, September 20th, if you're in the Park Ridge area of Chicagoland, you can come out and see me hosting a screening of Meet the Parents. No, not the 2000 Ben Stiller comedy, but the 1992 original film that Universal Pictures bought and turned into the Ben Stiller comedy. I'm going to be hosting a Q&A afterwards with the actor and writer-director, Greg Gliena, and some other folks who produced and were in the film. So tickets and information can be found at the website below, which I still have to add. So look for that tomorrow. That's what I'll be doing. So come on out and yell at me for not liking Beetlejuice from the audience. But that might be kind of
weird.
We'll
send some plants. Movie. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Ooh, I like plants.
Anyway. Plants to yell at you about Beetlejuice.
I would never yell at someone for not liking a film.
No, but
I'll just sit there.
That's what makes you a better movie than I. Or better person than I. A movie. Come on. Yeah.
We need to send that. We need to send Jason Lee in to help you out here. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that kind of plant is what I'm talking about. Like, let's just
be it. for screen to screen, does that mean we're going to have to watch The Crow?
Well, no, David, you got out of that because we already talked about The Crow a couple years ago. I think we did a page to screen on that.
I mean, the new one, you know.
Well, right, but I don't know if I want to put myself
into
that.
Don't do it.
Maybe we could bring Alex Proas in.
Don't do it.
There you go.
Don't. You don't need to give any more attention to The Crow 2024 than it's already gotten.
Now you're tempting me, Mark. Did you say Hawk Tua?
Hawk nice. Tua.
Wow.
Don't say that. I think that's trademarked now.
Well, she's got a podcast now, guys. Have you heard about this? Do you know what it's called?
Let's bring her on Economy is Yellow. Yeah.
Hawk Tua.
It's called Talk Tua. So as with The Crow remake, I'm going to quote Hawk Tua and say, spit on that thing. But anyway, we've been Earth's Mightiest Critics. You know us, you love us, even if you don't love our opinions. I'm specifically talking about mine. But thanks. I am Ian Simmons of Kicking the Seat. We have Mark the Movie Man Krawcheck of Special Mark Productions and the Spoiler Room Podcast, Don Shanahan of Film Obsessive and the Cinephile History Podcast, and David Fowley of Keeping It Real, just like our Willem Dafoe character in Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. And until next time, oh, by the way, if you like this stream, please like and subscribe and support all of Earth's Mightiest Critics. Their information is down below. And until next time, whenever that is, whatever that is, thanks very much. Take care, and it's no longer showtime. Was that terrible? Yeah.
It's showtime.